course, like the spark of fire in a haystack. From The Borgias by Ivan Klula. The Trap at Sinigalia. On the day Ramiro was executed, Cesare Borgia quit Cesena, leaving the mutilated body on the town square, and marched south. 3 days later, he arrived at Fano, where he received the envoys of the city of Ancona, who assured him of their loyalty. A messenger from Vitellozzo Vitelli announced that the little Adriatic port of Sinigalia had surrendered to the condottiere, mercenary soldiers. Only the citadel, in the charge of Genoese Andrea Doria, still held out, and Doria refused to hand it over to anyone except Cesare himself. Borgia sent word that he would arrive the next day, which was just what the condottiere wanted to hear. Once he reached Sinigalia, Cesare would be an easy prey, caught between the citadel and their forces ringing the town. The condottiere were sure they had military superiority, believing that the departure of the French troops had left Cesare with only a small force. In fact, according to Machiavelli, Borgia had left Cesena with 10,000 infantrymen and 3,000 horse, taking pains to split up his men so that they would march along parallel routes before converging on Sinigalia. The reason for such a large force was that he knew from a confession extracted from Ramiro de Lorca what the condottieri had up their sleeve. He therefore decided to turn their own trap against them. This was the masterpiece of trickery that the historian Paolo Jovio later called the Magnificent Deceit. At dawn on December 31st, 1502, Cesare reached the outskirts of Sinigalia. Led by Micheletto Corella, Cesare's advance guard of 200 lances took up its position on the canal bridge. This control of the ridge effectively prevented the conspirators' troops from withdrawing. Cesare greeted the condottieri effusively and invited them to join him. Michelotto had prepared the Palazzo Bernardino for Cesare's use, and the Duke invited the condottieri inside. Once indoors, the men were quietly arrested by guards who crept up from the rear. Cesare gave orders for an attack on Vitelli's and Orsini's soldiers in the outlying areas. That night, while their troops were being crushed, Micheletto throttled Oliveretto and Vitelli in the Bernardino Palace. At one fell swoop, Borgia had got rid of his former generals and worst enemies. And from Napoleon Bonaparte, "To have ultimate victory, you must be ruthless." The 16th Law. Use absence to increase respect and honor. Judgment. Too much circulation makes the price go down. The more you are seen and heard from, the more common you appear. If you are already established in a group, temporary withdrawal from it will make you more talked about, even more admired. You must learn when to leave. Create value through scarcity. Transgression and observance of the law. Sir Guillaume de Ballon was a troubadour who roamed the south of France in the Middle Ages, going from castle to castle, reciting poetry, and playing the perfect knight. At the castle of Javillac, he met and fell in love with the beautiful lady of the house, Madame Guillaume de Javillac. He sang her his songs, recited his poetry, played chess with her, and little by little she in turn fell in love with him. Guillaume had a friend, Sir Pierre de Barjac, who traveled with him, and who was also received at the castle. And Pierre, too, fell in love with a lady in Javillac, the gracious but temperamental Vianetta. One day Pierre and Vianetta had a violent quarrel. The lady dismissed him, and he sought out his friend Guillaume to help heal the breach and get him back in her good graces. Guillaume was about to leave the castle for a while, but on his return, several weeks later, he worked his magic, and Pierre and the lady were reconciled. Pierre felt that his love had increased tenfold, that there was no stronger love, in fact, than the love that follows reconciliation. The stronger and longer the disagreement, he told Guillaume, the sweeter the feeling that comes with peace and rapprochement. As a troubadour, Sir Guillaume prided himself on experiencing all the joys and sorrows of love. On hearing his friends talk, he too wanted to know the bliss of reconciliation after a quarrel. He therefore feigned great anger with Lady Guillaume, stopped sending her love letters, and abruptly left the castle and stayed away, even during the festivals and hunts. This drove the young lady wild. Guillaume sent messengers to Guillaume to find out what had happened, but he turned the messengers away. He thought all this would make her angry, forcing him to plead for reconciliation as Pierre had. Instead, however, his absence had the opposite effect. It made Guillaume love him all the more. Now the lady pursued her knight, sending messengers and love notes of her own. This was almost unheard of. A lady never pursued her troubadour. And Guillaume didn't like it. Guillaume's forwardness made him feel she had lost some of her dignity. Not only was he no longer sure of his plan, he was no longer sure of his lady. Finally, after several months of not hearing from Guillaume, Guillaume gave up. She sent him no more messengers, and he began to wonder. Perhaps she was angry. Perhaps the plan had worked after all. So much the better if she was. He would wait no more. It was time to reconcile. So he put on his best robe, decked the horse in its fanciest caparison, chose a magnificent helmet, and rode off to Javillac. On hearing that her beloved had returned, Guillaume rushed to see him, knelt before him, dropped her veil to kiss him, and begged forgiveness for whatever slight had caused his anger. Imagine his confusion and despair. His plan had failed abysmally. She was not angry. She had never been angry. She was only deeper in love, and he would never experience the joy of reconciliation after a quarrel. Seeing her now, and still desperate to taste that joy, he decided to try one more time. He drove her away with harsh words and threatening gestures. She left, this time vowing never to see him again. The next morning, the troubadour regretted what he had done. He rode back to Javillac, but the lady would not receive him, and ordered her servants to chase him away across the drawbridge and over the hill. Guillaume fled. Back in his chamber, he collapsed and started to cry. He had made a terrible mistake. Over the next year, unable to see his lady, he experienced the absence, the terrible absence that can only inflame love. He wrote one of his most beautiful poems, "My Song Ascends for Mercy Praying," and he sent many letters to Guillaume, explaining what he had done and begging forgiveness. After a great deal of this, Lady Guillaume, remembering his beautiful songs, his handsome figure, and his skills in dancing and falconry, found herself yearning to have him back. As penance for his cruelty, she ordered him to remove the nail from the little finger of his right hand and to send it to her along with a poem describing his miseries. He did as she asked. Finally, Guillaume de Ballon was able to taste the ultimate sensation, a reconciliation even surpassing that of his friend Pierre. Interpretation. Trying to discover the joys of reconciliation, Guillaume de Ballon inadvertently experienced the truth of the law of absence and presence. At the start of an affair, you need to heighten your presence in the eyes of the other. If you absent yourself too early, you may be forgotten. But once your lover's emotions are engaged and the feeling of love has crystallized, absence inflames and excites. Giving no reason for your absence excites even more. The other person assumes he or she is at fault. While you are away, the lover's imagination takes flight, and a stimulated imagination cannot help but make love grow stronger. Conversely, the more Guillaume pursued Guillaume, the less he loved her. She had become too present, too accessible, leaving no room for his imagination and fancy, so that his feelings were suffocating. When she finally stopped sending messengers, he was able to breathe again and to return to his plan. What withdraws, what becomes scarce, suddenly seems to deserve our respect and honor. What stays too long, inundating us with its presence, makes us disdain it. In the Middle Ages, ladies were constantly putting their knights through trials of love, sending them on some long and arduous quest, all to create a pattern of absence and presence. Indeed, had Guillaume not left his lady in the first place, she might have been forced to send him away, creating an absence of her own. As La Rochefoucauld said, Absence diminishes minor passions and inflames great ones, as the wind douses a candle and fans a fire. Observance of the Law. For many centuries, the Assyrians ruled Upper Asia with an iron fist. In the 8th century BC, however, the people of Media, now northwestern Iran, revolted against them and finally broke free. Now the Medes had to establish a new government. Determined to avoid any form of despotism, they refused to give ultimate power to any one man or to establish a monarchy. Without a leader, however, the country soon fell into chaos and fractured into small kingdoms, with village fighting against village. In one such village lived a man named Deilses, who began to make a name for himself for fair dealing and the ability to settle disputes. He did this so successfully, in fact, that soon any legal conflict in the area was brought to him, and his power increased. Throughout the land, the law had fallen into disrepute. The judges were corrupt, and no one entrusted their cases to the courts anymore, resorting to violence instead. When news spread of Deilses' wisdom, incorruptibility, and unshakable impartiality, Median villages far and wide turned to him to settle all manner of cases. Soon he became the sole arbiter of justice in the land. At the height of his power, Deilses suddenly decided he had had enough. He would no longer sit in the chair of judgment, would hear no more suits, settle no more disputes between brother and brother, village and village. Complaining that he was spending so much time dealing with other people's problems that he had neglected his own affairs, he retired. The country once again descended into chaos. With the sudden withdrawal of a powerful arbiter like Deilses, crime increased, and contempt for the law was never greater. The Medes held a meeting of all the villages to decide how to get out of their predicament. "We cannot continue to live in this country under these conditions," said one tribal leader. "Let us appoint one of our number to rule, so that we can live under orderly government, rather than losing our homes altogether in the present chaos." And so, despite all that the Medes had suffered under the Assyrian despotism, they decided to set up a monarchy and name a king. And the man they most wanted to rule, of course, was the fair-minded Deilses. He was hard to convince, for he wanted nothing more to do with the village's infighting and bickering. But the Medes begged and pleaded. Without him, the country had descended into a state of lawlessness. Deilses finally agreed. Yet he also imposed conditions. An enormous palace was to be constructed for him. He was to be provided with bodyguards, and a capital city was to be built from which he could rule. All of this was done, and Deilses settled into his palace. In the center of the capital, the palace was surrounded by walls and completely inaccessible to ordinary people. Deilses then established the terms of his rule. Admission to his presence was forbidden. Communication with the king was only possible through messengers. No one in the royal court could see him more than once a week, and then only by permission. Deilses ruled for 53 years, extended the Median Empire, and established the foundation for what would later be the Persian Empire, under his great-great-grandson Cyrus. During Deilses' reign, the people's respect for him gradually turned into a form of worship. He was not a mere mortal, they believed, but the son of a god. Interpretation. Deilses was a man of great ambition. He determined early on that the country needed a strong ruler, and that he was the man for the job. In a land plagued with anarchy, the most powerful man is the judge and arbiter. So Deilses began his career by making his reputation as a man of impeccable fairness. At the height of his power as a judge, however, Deilses realized the truth of the law of absence and presence. By serving so many clients, he had become too noticeable, too available, and had lost the respect he had earlier enjoyed. People were taking his services for granted. The only way to regain the veneration and power he wanted was to withdraw completely, and let the Medes taste what life was like without him. As he expected, they came begging for him to rule. Once Deilses had discovered the truth of this law, he carried it to its ultimate realization. In the palace his people had built for him, none could see him except a few courtiers, and those only rarely. As Herodotus wrote, there was a risk that if they saw him habitually, it might lead to jealousy and resentment, and plots would follow. But if nobody saw him, the legend would grow, and he was a being of a different order from mere men. As Mullah Jami said, a man said to a dervish, why do I not see you more often? The dervish replied, because the words, why have you not been to see me, are sweeter to my ears than the words, why have you come again? Keys to power. Everything in the world depends on absence and presence. A strong presence will draw power and attention to you. You shine more brightly than those around you. But a point is inevitably reached where too much presence creates the opposite effect. The more you are seen and heard from, the more your value degrades. You become a habit. No matter how hard you try to be different, subtly, without your knowing why, people respect you less and less. At the right moment, you must learn to withdraw yourself before they unconsciously push you away. It is a game of hide-and-seek. The truth of this law can most easily be appreciated in matters of love and seduction. In the beginning stages of an affair, the lover's absence stimulates your imagination, forming a sort of aura around him or her. But this aura fades when you know too much, when your imagination no longer has room to roam. The loved one becomes a person like anyone else, a person whose presence is taken for granted. This is why the 17th century French courtisan, Ninon de L'Enclos, advised constant feints at withdrawal from one's lover. Love never dies of starvation, she wrote, but often of indigestion. The moment you allow yourself to be treated like anyone else, it is too late. You are swallowed and digested. To prevent this, you need to starve the other person of your presence. Force their respect by threatening them with the possibility that they will lose you for good. Create a pattern of presence and absence. Once you die, everything about you will seem different. You will be surrounded by an instant aura of respect. People will remember their criticisms of you, their arguments with you, and will be filled with regret and guilt. They are missing a presence that will never return. But you do not have to wait until you die. By completely withdrawing for a while, you create a kind of death before death. And when you come back, it will be as if you had come back from the dead. An air of resurrection will cling to you, and people will be relieved at your return. This is how Dionysus made himself king. Napoleon was recognizing the law of absence and presence when he said, if I am often seen at the theater, people will cease to notice me. Today, in a world inundated with presence through the flood of images, the game of withdrawal is all the more powerful. We rarely know when to withdraw anymore, and nothing seems private, so we are awed by anyone who is able to disappear by choice. Novelists J.D. Salinger and Thomas Pynchon have created cult-like followings by knowing when to disappear. Another, more everyday side of this law, but one that demonstrates its truth even farther, is the law of scarcity in the science of economics. By withdrawing something from the market, you create instant value. In 17th century Holland, the upper classes wanted to make the tulip more than just a beautiful flower. They wanted it to be a kind of status symbol. Making the flower scarce, indeed almost impossible to obtain, they sparked what was later called tulipomania. A single flower was now worth more than its weight in gold. In our own century, similarly, the art dealer Joseph Duveen insisted on making the paintings he sold as scarce and rare as possible. To keep their prices elevated and their status high, he bought up whole collections and stored them in his basement. The paintings that he sold became more than just paintings. They were fetish objects. Their value increased by their rarity. You can get all the pictures you want at $50,000 apiece. That's easy, he once said. But to get pictures at $250,000 apiece, that wants doing. Extend the law of scarcity to your own skills. Make what you are offering the world rare and hard to find, and you instantly increase its value. There always comes a moment when those in power overstay their welcome. We have grown tired of them, lost respect for them. We see them as no different from the rest of mankind, which is to say that we see them as rather worse, since we inevitably compare their current status in our eyes to their former one. There is an art to knowing when to retire. If it is done right, you regain the respect you had lost and retain a part of your power. The greatest ruler of the 16th century was Charles V. King of Spain, Habsburg Emperor, he governed an empire that at one point included much of Europe and the New World. Yet at the height of his power, in 1557, he retired to the monastery of Yuste. All of Europe was captivated by his sudden withdrawal. People who had hated and feared him suddenly called him great, and he came to be seen as a saint. In more recent times, the film actress Greta Garbo was never more admired than when she retired in 1941. For some, her absence came too soon. She was in her mid-30s, but she wisely preferred to leave on her own terms rather than waiting for her audience to grow tired of her. Make yourself too available, and the aura of power you have created around yourself will wear away. Turn the game around. Make yourself less accessible, and you increase the value of your presence. Reversal. This law only applies once a certain level of power has been attained. The need to withdraw only comes after you have established your presence. Leave too early, and you don't increase your respect, you are simply forgotten. When you're first entering onto the world stage, create an image that is recognizable, reproducible, and is seen everywhere. Until that status is attained, absence is dangerous. Instead of fanning the flames, it will extinguish them. In love and seduction, similarly, absence is only effective once you have surrounded the other with your image, been seen by him or her everywhere. Everything must remind your lover of your presence, so that when you do choose to be away, the lover will always be thinking of you, will always be seeing you in his or her mind's eye. Remember, in the beginning, make yourself not scarce, but omnipresent. Only what is seen, appreciated, and loved will be missed in its absence. Here are some further reflections on this law. From the Selected Fables of Jean de La Fontaine. The Camel and the Floating Sticks. The first man who saw a camel fled. The second ventured within distance. The third dared slip a halter round its head. Familiarity in this existence makes all things tame. For what may seem terrible or bizarre when once our eyes have had time to acclimatize becomes quite commonplace. Since I'm on this theme, I've heard of sentinels posted by the shore who, spotting something far away afloat, couldn't resist the shout, "A sail! A sail! A mighty man of war!" 5 minutes later, it's a packet boat, and then a skiff, and then a bale, and finally some sticks bobbing about. I know plenty such to whom this story applies, people whom distance magnifies, who, close to, don't amount to much. And an ancient Chinese parable. Five Virtues of the Cock. While serving under the Duke Ai of Lu, Chen Zhao, resenting his obscure position, said to his master, "I am going to wander far away like a snow goose."
"What do you mean by that?" inquired the Duke.
"Do you see the cock?" said Chen Zhao in reply. "Its crest is a symbol of civility. Its powerful talons suggest strength. Its daring to fight any enemy denotes courage. Its instinct to invite others whenever food is obtained shows benevolence. And last but not least, its punctuality in keeping the time through the night gives us an example of veracity. In spite, however, of these five virtues, the cock is daily killed to fill a dish on your table. Why? The reason is that it is found within our reach. On the other hand, the snow goose traverses in one flight 1,000 li. Resting in your garden, it preys on your fishes and turtles and pecks your millet. Though devoid of any of the cock's five virtues, yet you prize this bird for the sake of its scarcity. This being so, I shall fly far like a snow goose."
The 17th Law.
keep others in suspended terror. Cultivate an air of unpredictability. Judgment. Humans are creatures of habit with an insatiable need to see familiarity in other people's actions. Your predictability gives them a sense of control. Turn the tables. Be deliberately unpredictable. Behavior that seems to have no consistency or purpose will keep them off balance, and they will wear themselves out trying to explain your moves. Taken to an extreme, this strategy can intimidate and terrorize. Observance of the law. In May of 1972, chess champion Boris Spassky anxiously awaited his rival Bobby Fischer in Reykjavik, Iceland. The two men had been scheduled to meet for the World Championship of Chess, but Fischer hadn't arrived on time, and the match was on hold. Fischer had problems with the size of the prize money, problems with the way the money was to be distributed, problems with the logistics of holding the match in Iceland. He might back out at any moment. Spassky tried to be patient. His Russian bosses felt that Fischer was humiliating him and told him to walk away. But Spassky wanted this match. He knew he could destroy Fischer, and nothing was going to spoil the greatest victory of his career. "So it seems that all our work may come to nothing," Spassky told a comrade. "But what can we do? It is Bobby's move. If he comes, we play. If he does not come, we do not play. A man who is willing to commit suicide has the initiative." Fischer finally arrived in Reykjavik, but the problems and the threat of cancellation continued. He disliked the hall where the match was to be fought. He criticized the lighting. He complained about the noise of the cameras. He even hated the chairs in which he and Spassky were to sit. Now the Soviet Union took the initiative and threatened to withdraw their man. The bluff apparently worked. After all the weeks of waiting, the endless and infuriating negotiations, Fischer agreed to play. Everyone was relieved, no one more than Spassky. But on the day of the official introductions, Fischer arrived very late. And on the day when the match of the century was to begin, he was late again. This time, however, the consequences would be dire. If he showed up too late, he would forfeit the first game. What was going on? Was he playing some sort of mind game? Or was Bobby Fischer perhaps afraid of Boris Spassky? It seemed to the assembled grandmasters and to Spassky that this young kid from Brooklyn had a terrible case of the jitters. At 5:09, Fischer showed up exactly 1 minute before the match was to be canceled. The first game of a chess tournament is critical, since it sets the tone for the months to come. It is often a slow and quiet struggle, with the two players preparing themselves for the war and trying to read each other's strategies. This game was different. Fischer made a terrible move early on, perhaps the worst of his career, and when Spassky had him on the ropes, he seemed to give up. Yet Spassky knew that Fischer never gave up. Even when facing checkmate, he fought to the bitter end, wearing the opponent down. This time, though, he seemed resigned. Then suddenly he broke out a bold move that put the room in a buzz. The move shocked Spassky, but he recovered and managed to win the game. But no one could figure out what Fischer was up to. Had he lost deliberately? Or was he rattled, unsettled, even, as some thought, insane? After his defeat in the first game, Fischer complained all the more loudly about the room, the cameras, and everything else. He also failed to show up on time for the second game. This time the organizers had had enough. He was given a forfeit. Now he was down 2-0, a position from which no one had ever come back to win a chess championship. Fischer was clearly unhinged. Yet in the third game, as all those who witnessed it remembered, he had a ferocious look in his eye, a look that clearly bothered Spassky. And despite the hole he had dug for himself, he seemed supremely confident. He did make what appeared to be another blunder, as he had in the first game. But his cocky air made Spassky smell a trap. Yet despite the Russian suspicions, he couldn't figure out the trap. And before he knew it, Fischer had checkmated him. In fact, Fischer's unorthodox tactics had completely unnerved his opponent.
At the end of the game, Fisher leaped up and rushed out, yelling to his confederates as he smashed a fist into his palm, "I'm crushing him with brute force." In the next games, Fisher pulled moves that no one had seen from him before, moves that were not his style. Now Spassky started to make blunders. After losing the sixth game, he started to cry. One grandmaster said, "After this, Spassky's got to ask himself if it's safe to go back to Russia." After the eighth game, Spassky decided he knew what was happening. Bobby Fischer was hypnotizing him. He decided not to look Fischer in the eye. He lost anyway. After the 14th game, he called a staff conference and announced, "An attempt is being made to control my mind." He wondered whether the orange juice they drank at the chess table could have been drugged. Maybe chemicals were being blown into the air. Finally, Spassky went public, accusing the Fischer team of putting something in the chairs that was altering Spassky's mind. The KGB went on alert. Boris Spassky was embarrassing the Soviet Union. The chairs were taken apart and x-rayed. A chemist found nothing unusual in them. The only things anyone found anywhere, in fact, were two dead flies and a lighting fixture. Spassky began to complain of hallucinations. He tried to keep playing, but his mind was unraveling. He couldn't go on. On September 2nd, he resigned. Although still relatively young, he never recovered from this defeat. Interpretation. In previous games between Fischer and Spassky, Fischer had not fared well. Spassky had an uncanny ability to read his opponent's strategy and use it against him. Adaptable and patient, he would build attacks that would defeat not in 7 moves, but in 70. He defeated Fischer every time they played, because he saw much further ahead, and because he was a brilliant psychologist who never lost control. One master said, "He doesn't just look for the best move. He looks for the move that will disturb the man he is playing." Fischer, however, finally understood that this was one of the keys to Spassky's success. He played on your predictability, defeated you at your own game. Everything Fischer did for the championship match was an attempt to put the initiative on his side and to keep Spassky off balance. Clearly, the endless waiting had an effect on Spassky's psyche. Most powerful of all, though, were Fischer's deliberate blunders and his appearance of having no clear strategy. In fact, he was doing everything he could to scramble his old patterns, even if it meant losing the first match and forfeiting the second. Spassky was known for his sang-froid and level-headedness. But for the first time in his life, he couldn't figure out his opponent. He slowly melted down, until at the end, he was the one who seemed insane. Chess contains the concentrated essence of life. First, because to win you have to be supremely patient and far-seeing. And second, because the game is built on patterns, whole sequences of moves that have been played before and will be played again with slight alterations in any one match. Your opponent analyzes the patterns you are playing and uses them to try to foresee your moves. Allowing him nothing predictable to base his strategy on gives you a big advantage. In chess, as in life, when people cannot figure out what you're doing, they are kept in a state of terror, waiting, uncertain, confused. As Jean de la Bruyère said, "Life at court is a serious, melancholy game of chess, which requires us to draw up our pieces and batteries, form a plan, pursue it, parry that of our adversary. Sometimes, however, it is better to take risks and play the most capricious, unpredictable move." Keys to power. Nothing is more terrifying than the sudden and unpredictable. That is why we are so frightened by earthquakes and tornadoes. We do not know when they will strike. After one has occurred, we wait in terror for the next one. To a lesser degree, this is the effect that unpredictable human behavior has on us. Animals behave in set patterns, which is why we are able to hunt and kill them. Only man has the capacity to consciously alter his behavior, to improvise and overcome the weight of routine and habit. Yet most men do not realize this power. They prefer the comforts of routine, of giving in to the animal nature that has them repeating the same compulsive actions time and time again. They do this because it requires no effort, and because they mistakenly believe that if they do not unsettle others, they will be left alone. Understand, a person of power instills a kind of fear by deliberately unsettling those around him, to keep the initiative on his side. You sometimes need to strike without warning, to make others tremble when they least expect it. It is a device that the powerful have used for centuries. Filippo Maria, the last of the Visconti dukes of Milan in 15th century Italy, consciously did the opposite of what everyone expected of him. For instance, he might suddenly shower a courtier with attention, and then, once the man had come to expect a promotion to higher office, would suddenly start treating him with the utmost disdain. Confused, the man might leave the court, when the Duke would suddenly recall him and start treating him well again. Doubly confused, the courtier would wonder whether his assumption that he would be promoted had become obvious and offensive to the Duke, and would start to behave as if he no longer expected such honor. The Duke would rebuke him for his lack of ambition and would send him away. The secret of dealing with Filippo was simple. Do not presume to know what he wants. Do not try to guess what will please him. Never inject your will. Just surrender to his will. Then wait to see what happens. Amidst the confusion and uncertainty created, the Duke ruled supreme, unchallenged, and at peace. Unpredictability is most often the tactic of the master, but the underdog can use it to great effect. If you find yourself outnumbered or cornered, throw in a series of unpredictable moves. Your enemies will be so confused that they will pull back or make a tactical blunder. In the spring of 1862, during the American Civil War, General Stonewall Jackson and a force of 4,600 Confederate soldiers were tormenting the larger Union forces in the Shenandoah Valley. Meanwhile, not far away, General George Brinton McClellan, heading a force of 90,000 Union soldiers, was marching south from Washington, D.C. to lay siege to Richmond, Virginia, the Confederate capital. As the weeks of the campaign went by, Jackson repeatedly led his soldiers out of the Shenandoah Valley, then back to it. His movements made no sense. Was he preparing to help defend Richmond? Was he marching on Washington, now that McClellan's absence had left it unprotected? Was he heading north to wreak havoc up there? Why was his small force moving in circles? Jackson's inexplicable moves made the Union generals delay the march on Richmond as they waited to figure out what he was up to. Meanwhile, the South was able to pour reinforcements into the town. A battle that could have crushed the Confederacy turned into a stalemate. Jackson used this tactic time and again when facing numerically superior forces. Always mystify, mislead, and surprise the enemy, if possible, he said. Such tactics will win every time, and a small army may thus destroy a large one. This law applies not only to war, but to everyday situations. People are always trying to read the motives behind your actions, and to use your predictability against you. Throw in a completely inexplicable move, and you put them on the defensive. Because they don't understand you, they are unnerved, and in such a state you can easily intimidate them. Pablo Picasso once remarked, "The best calculation is the absence of calculation." Once you have attained a certain level of recognition, others generally figure that when you do something, it's for an intelligent reason. So it's really foolish to plot out your movements too carefully in advance. You're better off acting capriciously. For a while, Picasso worked with the art dealer, Paul Rosenberg. At first, he allowed him a fair amount of latitude in handling his paintings. Then one day, for no apparent reason, he told the man he would no longer give him any work to sell. As Picasso explained, Rosenberg would spend the next 48 hours trying to figure out why. Was I reserving things for some other dealer? I'd go on working and sleeping, and Rosenberg would spend his time figuring. In 2 days he'd come back, nerves jangled, anxious, saying, "After all, dear friend, you wouldn't turn me down if I offered you this much," naming a substantially higher figure, "for those paintings, rather than the price I've been accustomed to paying you, would you?"
Unpredictability is not only a weapon of terror. Scrambling your patterns on a day-to-day basis will cause a stir around you and stimulate interest. People will talk about you, ascribe motives and explanations that have nothing to do with the truth, but that keep you constantly in their minds. In the end, the more capricious you appear, the more respect you will garner. Only the terminally subordinate act in a predictable manner. Reversal. Sometimes predictability can work in your favor. By creating a pattern for people to be familiar and comfortable with, you can lull them to sleep. They have prepared everything according to their preconceived notions about you. You can use this in several ways. First, it sets up a smokescreen, a comfortable front, behind which you can carry on deceptive actions. Second, it allows you on rare occasions to do something completely against the pattern, unsettling your opponent so deeply he will fall to the ground without being pushed. In 1974, Muhammad Ali and George Foreman were scheduled to fight for the World Heavyweight Boxing Championship. Everyone knew what would happen. Big George Foreman would try to land a knockout punch, while Ali would dance around him, wearing him out. That was Ali's way of fighting, his pattern, and he hadn't changed it in more than 10 years. But in this case, it seemed to give Foreman the advantage. He had a devastating punch, and if he waited, sooner or later Ali would have to come to him. Ali, the master strategist, had other plans. In press conferences before the fight, he said he was going to change his style and punch it out with Foreman. No one, least of all Foreman, believed this for a second. That plan would be a suicide on Ali's part. He was playing the comedian as usual. Then, before the fight, Ali's trainer loosened the ropes around the ring, something a trainer would do if his boxer were intending to slug it out. But no one believed this ploy. It had to be a setup. To everyone's amazement, Ali did exactly what he had said he would do. As Foreman waited for him to dance around, Ali went right up to him and slugged it out. He completely upset his opponent's strategy. At a loss, Foreman ended up wearing himself out, not by chasing Ali, but by throwing punches wildly and taking more and more counterpunches. Finally, Ali landed a dramatic right cross that knocked out Foreman. The habit of assuming that a person's behavior will fit its previous patterns is so strong that not even Ali's announcement of a strategy change was enough to upset it. Foreman walked into a trap, the trap he had been told to expect. A warning. Unpredictability can work against you sometimes, especially if you are in a subordinate position. There are times when it is better to let people feel comfortable and settled around you than to disturb them. Too much unpredictability will be seen as a sign of indecisiveness, or even of some more serious psychic problem. Patterns are powerful, and you can terrify people by disrupting them. Such power should only be used judiciously. The 18th Law. Do not build fortresses to protect yourself. Isolation is dangerous. Judgment. The world is dangerous and enemies are everywhere. Everyone has to protect themselves. A fortress seems the safest, but isolation exposes you to more dangers than it protects you from. It cuts you off from valuable information. It makes you conspicuous and an easy target. Better to circulate among people, find allies, mingle. You are shielded from your enemies by the crowd. Transgression of the law. Qin Shi Huangdi, the first emperor of China, 221 to 210 BC, was the mightiest man of his day. His empire was vaster and more powerful than that of Alexander the Great. He had conquered all of the kingdoms surrounding his own kingdom of Qin and unified them into one massive realm called China. But in the last years of his life, few, if anyone, saw him. The emperor lived in the most magnificent palace built to that date, in the capital of Shangyang. The palace had 270 pavilions. All of these were connected by secret underground passageways, allowing the emperor to move through the palace without anyone seeing him. He slept in a different room every night,
and anyone who inadvertently laid eyes on him was instantly beheaded. Only a handful of men knew his whereabouts, and if they revealed it to anyone, they too were put to death. The first emperor had grown so terrified of human contact that when he had to leave the palace, he traveled incognito, disguising himself carefully. On one such trip through the provinces, he suddenly died. His body was borne back to the capital in the emperor's carriage, with a cart packed with salted fish trailing behind it to cover up the smell of the rotting corpse. No one was to know of his death. He died alone, far from his wives, his family, his friends, and his courtiers, accompanied only by a minister and a handful of eunuchs. Interpretation. Shi Huangti started off as the king of Qin, a fearless warrior of unbridled ambition. Writers of the time described him as a man with a waspish nose, eyes like slits, the voice of a jackal, and the heart of a tiger or wolf. He could be merciful sometimes, but more often he swallowed men up without a scruple. It was through trickery and violence that he conquered the provinces surrounding his own and created China, forging a single nation and culture out of many. He broke up the feudal system, and to keep an eye on the many members of the royal families that were scattered across the realm's various kingdoms, he moved 120,000 of them to the capital, where he housed the most important courtiers in the vast palace of Shanyang. He consolidated the many walls on the borders and built them into the Great Wall of China. He standardized the country's laws, its written language, even the size of its cartwheels. As part of its process of unification, however, the first emperor outlawed the writings and teachings of Confucius, the philosopher whose ideas on the moral life had already become virtually a religion in Chinese culture. On Shi Huangti's order, thousands of books relating to Confucius were burned, and anyone who quoted Confucius was to be beheaded. This made many enemies for the emperor, and he grew constantly afraid, even paranoid. The executions mounted. A contemporary, the writer Han Fei Tzu, noted that Qin has been victorious for four generations, yet has lived in constant terror and apprehension of destruction. As the emperor withdrew deeper and deeper into the palace to protect himself, he slowly lost control of the realm. Eunuchs and ministers enacted political policies without his approval or even his knowledge. They also plotted against him. By the end, he was emperor in name only, and was so isolated that barely anyone knew he had died. He had probably been poisoned by the same scheming ministers who encouraged his isolation. That is what isolation brings. Retreat into a fortress, and you lose contact with the sources of your power. You lose your ear for what is happening around you, as well as a sense of proportion. Instead of being safer, you cut yourself off from the kind of knowledge on which your life depends. Never enclose yourself so far from the streets that you cannot hear what is happening around you, including the plots against you. Observance of the law. Louis XIV had the Palace of Versailles built for him and his court in the 1660s. But it was like no other royal palace in the world. As in a beehive, everything revolved around the royal person. He lived surrounded by the nobility, who were allotted apartments nestled around his. Their closeness to him depended on their rank. The king's bedroom occupied the literal center of the palace, and was the focus of everyone's attention. Every morning the king was greeted in his room by a ritual known as the levee. At 8 a.m., the king's first valet, who slept at the foot of the royal bed, would awaken his majesty. Then pages would open the door and admit those who had a function in the levee. The order of their entry was precise. First came the king's illegitimate sons and his grandchildren. Then the princes and princesses of the blood. And then his physician and surgeon. There followed the grand officers of the wardrobe, the king's official reader, and those in charge of entertaining the king. Next would arrive various government officials in ascending order of rank. Last but not least came those attending the levee by special invitation. By the end of the ceremony, the room would be packed with well over 100 royal attendants and visitors.
The day was organized so that all the palace's energy was directed at and passed through the king. Louis was constantly attended by courtiers and officials, all asking for his advice and judgment. To all their questions, he usually replied, "I shall see." As Saint-Simon noted, if he turned to someone, asked him a question, made an insignificant remark, the eyes of all present were turned on this person. It was a distinction that was talked of and increased prestige. There was no possibility of privacy in the palace, not even for the king. Every room communicated with another, and every hallway led to larger rooms where groups of nobles gathered constantly. Everyone's actions were interdependent, and nothing and no one passed unnoticed. "The king not only saw to it that all the high nobility was present at his court," wrote Saint-Simon, "he demanded the same of the minor nobility. At his levee and coucher, at his meals, in his gardens of Versailles, he always looked about him, noticing everything. He was offended if the most distinguished nobles didn't live permanently at court, and those who showed themselves never, or hardly ever, incurred his full displeasure. If one of these desired something, the king would say proudly, 'I do not know him,' and the judgment was irrevocable." Interpretation. Louis XIV came to power at the end of a terrible civil war, the Fronde. A principal instigator of the war had been the nobility, which deeply resented the growing power of the throne and yearned for the days of feudalism, when the lords ruled their own fiefdoms and the king had little authority over them. The nobles had lost the civil war, but they remained a fractious, resentful lot. The construction of Versailles, then, was far more than the decadent whim of a luxury-loving king. It served a crucial function. The king could keep an eye and an ear on everyone and everything around him. The once proud nobility was reduced to squabbling over the right to help the king put on his robes in the morning. There was no possibility here of privacy, no possibility of isolation. Louis XIV very early grasped the truth that for a king to isolate himself is gravely dangerous. In his absence, conspiracies will spring up like mushrooms after rain. Animosities will crystallize into factions, and rebellion will break out before he has the time to react. To combat this, sociability and openness must not only be encouraged, they must be formally organized and channeled. These conditions at Versailles lasted for Louis's entire reign, some 50 years of relative peace and tranquility. Through it all, not a pin dropped without Louis hearing it. As Dr. Samuel Johnson said, "Solitude is dangerous to reason, without being favorable to virtue." Remember that the solitary mortal is certainly luxurious, probably superstitious, and possibly mad. Keys to power. Machiavelli makes the argument that, in a strictly military sense, a fortress is invariably a mistake. It becomes a symbol of power's isolation, and is an easy target for its builder's enemies. Designed to defend you, fortresses actually cut you off from help and cut into your flexibility. They may appear impregnable, but once you retire to one, everyone knows where you are. And a siege doesn't have to succeed to turn your fortress into a prison. With their small and confined spaces, fortresses are also extremely vulnerable to the plague and contagious diseases. In a strategic sense, the isolation of a fortress provides no protection, and actually creates more problems than it solves. Because human beings are social creatures by nature, power depends on social interaction and circulation. To make yourself powerful, you must place yourself at the center of things, as Louis XIV did at Versailles. All activity should revolve around you, and you should be aware of everything happening on the street and of anyone who might be hatching plots against you. The danger for most people comes when they feel threatened. In such times, they tend to retreat and close ranks to find security in a kind of fortress. In doing so, however, they come to rely for information on a smaller and smaller circle and lose perspective on events around them. They lose maneuverability and become easy targets, and their isolation makes them paranoid. As in warfare and most games of strategy, isolation often precedes defeat and death. In moments of uncertainty and danger, you need to fight this desire to turn inward. Instead, make yourself more accessible. Seek out old allies and make new ones. Force yourself into more and more different circles. This has been the trick of powerful people for centuries. The Roman statesman Cicero was born into the lower nobility and had little chance of power unless he managed to make a place for himself among the aristocrats who controlled the city. He succeeded brilliantly, identifying everyone with influence and figuring out how they were connected to one another. He mingled everywhere, knew everyone, and had such a vast network of connections that an enemy here could easily be counterbalanced by an ally there. The French statesman Talleyrand played the game the same way. Although he came from one of the oldest aristocratic families in France, he made a point of always staying in touch with what was happening in the streets of Paris, allowing him to foresee trends and troubles. He even got a certain pleasure out of mingling with shady criminal types, who supplied him with valuable information. Every time there was a crisis, a transition of power, the end of the Directory, the fall of Napoleon, the abdication of Louis XVIII, he was able to survive and even thrive because he never closed himself up in a small circle, but always forged connections with a new order. This law pertains to kings and queens and to those of the highest power. The moment you lose contact with your people, seeking security in isolation, rebellion is brewing. Never imagine yourself so elevated that you can afford to cut yourself off from even the lowest echelons. By retreating to a fortress, you make yourself an easy target for your plotting subjects, who view your isolation as an insult and a reason for rebellion. Since humans are such social creatures, it follows that the social arts that make us pleasant to be around can be practiced only by constant exposure and circulation. The more you are in contact with others, the more graceful and at ease you become. Isolation, on the other hand, engenders an awkwardness in your gestures and leads to further isolation as people start avoiding you. In 1545, Duke Cosimo I de' Medici decided that to ensure the immortality of his name, he would commission frescoes for the main chapel of the Church of San Lorenzo in Florence. He had many great painters to choose from, and in the end he picked Jacopo da Pontormo. Getting on in years, Pontormo wanted to make these frescoes his chef-d'oeuvre and legacy. His first decision was to close the chapel off with walls, partitions, and blinds. He wanted no one to witness the creation of his masterpiece, or to steal his ideas. He would outdo Michelangelo himself. When some young men broke into the chapel out of curiosity, Jacopo sealed it off even further. Pontormo filled the chapel's ceiling with biblical scenes, the creation, Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, on and on. At the top of the middle wall, he painted Christ in his majesty, raising the dead on Judgment Day. The artist worked on the chapel for 11 years, rarely leaving it, since he had developed a phobia for human contact and was afraid his ideas would be stolen. Pontormo died before completing the frescoes, and none of them has survived. But the great Renaissance writer Vasari, a friend of Pontormo's, who saw the frescoes shortly after the artist's death, left a description of what they looked like. There was a total lack of proportion. Scenes bumped against scenes, figures in one story being juxtaposed with those in another, in maddening numbers. Pontormo had become obsessed with detail, but had lost any sense of the overall composition. Vasari left off his description of the frescoes by writing that if he continued, "I think I would go mad and become entangled in this painting. Just as I believe that in the 11 years of time Jacopo spent on it, he entangled himself and anyone else who saw it." Instead of crowning Pontormo's career, the work became his undoing. These frescoes were visual equivalents of the effects of isolation on the human mind. A loss of proportion, an obsession with detail, combined with an inability to see the larger picture. A kind of extravagant ugliness that no longer communicates. Clearly, isolation is as deadly for the creative arts as for the social arts. Shakespeare is the most famous writer in history because, as a dramatist for the popular stage, he opened himself up to the masses, making his work accessible to people no matter what their education and taste. Artists who hold themselves up in their fortress lose a sense of proportion. Their